Commissioner, you're on.
All right, let's see. Lana's here, Sue's here, Pat's here, Austin's here, my colleagues are here. All right. All right, good afternoon, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. We're meeting at the Capitol today. It's approximately 1 p.m. It is Monday, December 15th, 2014. This is a Public Service Commission meeting in the Public Service Commission hearing room on the 12th floor in the Capitol for the purpose of conducting a public hearing on proposed changes to the Commission's administrative rules. The rules cases being heard today are case number GS-14-761 concerning gas pipeline safety. Mr. Fawn from staff will be presenting the staff testimony, and then we'll see if we have anyone from the public on public testimony. The second case will be case number AD-14-762 concerning procedural rules changes. Austin from, I guess, Austin, I'll call you staff today, correct? Our top-notch intern. And finally, case number GE-14-763 concerning licensing proposed changes. Sue from staff will be presenting the staff testimony. I'm Brian Kalk, Chairman of the Public Service Commission. With me today are my colleagues, Commissioner Randy Christman, who holds the portfolio, and Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk. Before I turn it over to my colleagues to see if they have any opening comments, I just kind of want to walk everyone through this. There's some formality, I guess, here how we're doing this, but please don't get overwhelmed by the formality. It's just we have to develop the record, and then the way this works is the staff will open up their why they're recommending these changes. The commissioners, we've all heard their testimony before, and then once the staff member is done, and then what we'll do is any members of the public that want to say their piece are welcome to do so. And I think, Alana, is it okay if the public just sits down there and grabs a microphone and have them come up here? It doesn't really matter, does it? Yeah, so Pat, if you want to sit down, it doesn't matter. We're not going to swear anybody in or anything like that. It's just set up that way. And the three rules are, we lump them together because that's what we have to do, and then we'll submit a rules package. Just for show of hands, how many of you are here to testify on questions about the gas pipeline safety? Other than Pat? Not even MDU? You're just here to listen, huh? Okay, so that'll go very quickly. Anybody here for procedural rules besides Austin from our staff? Okay, so that'll move along pretty quickly. That's kind of what we guessed. And then so that I think the rest of you are here for the concerns about licensing changes. So what we'll do is we'll go through those first two, and then I think those will move along. We may or may not take a break going to the third one, probably not. And then we'll just go. We're not going to plan on limiting testimony. That's not the plan here. But if we get to where one of you has been talking like a half hour, maybe we'll back off because we'll get a show of hands ahead of time. So we, you know, hopefully we're not here till 10 o'clock tonight. But we will be if need be. I think once you get your points out there, that's really what we're looking for. So that's the opening comments that I'd have. I'd see if Commissioner Christman has any before I finish out the rest of the script and we get into it.
Well, welcome everybody here. And I think the important two things to remember, and one of them Commissioner Kalk mentioned, is that we need to hear from you because we're trying to establish a record. And so that's important in that it's much better for you to tell us here on the record than to wait and then call in the evening or something and say, you know, but the point you missed is this or that. Then it's kind of too late. We need it here. And secondly, this isn't an adversarial situation. As portfolio holder, and I think I speak for my fellow commissioners, it's like we're trying to accomplish something and someone else in the room is the opponent. We're trying to get the right thing done to do our jobs here, and so the only way we can do that is to hear from people who are impacted by it. And so it's not that we're trying to accomplish do a certain set of rules. We're trying to do a set of rules that will do the best job for the people. So that's the goal, and so I really look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Sure. I'll just echo Randy's comments. I really appreciate that there's a good group of folks here to testify and tell us what you think about these proposed rules. The goal is to find that good balance between working with industry and addressing your needs while also doing the best job we can. And our charge, which is to protect farmers in terms of the bonding side of things. So it'll be great to hear from you. I want to thank Randy, too, for putting these together. It's an issue we've talked a lot about in the 2 years we've been on the commission and have struggled with some insolvencies. How can we do the job as good as possible? and are rules set up the way they should be today, recognizing some of the changes that have occurred in this industry over the last decade. And so I really appreciate you taking a stab at this and thinking outside the box and coming up with some new ideas and some new approaches here, and then also in some of the legislative side of things that will come to follow. So thank you, Randy, for doing that, and I look forward to everybody's input.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. The Commission has scheduled a public hearing to allow everyone the opportunity to submit information or comments concerning the adoption of proposed changes to the North Dakota Administrative Code. All comments received at the public hearing will be considered by the Commission, together with all written comments received. The last day to submit written comments is December 26, 2014. I'm just going to highlight this a little bit, that in our hearings for citing, the only record we can consider is what happens in the actual hearing process. There is a small adjustment to this format. People are allowed to submit written comments up until December 26th. So if someone's out there listening, they are certainly welcome to send their comments to us by that time, and we can consider that. So it's a little bit different than our traditional hearings, where the comments can only be that we can consider are inside the format. So those of you out there in the listening audience are certainly welcome to send those to us as well. The Public Service Commission will consider all the comments received and address the comments in its written decision. Anyone may request a copy of the decision, and one will be provided via email or regular mail. The decision and all other filings in each case will also be available on the Commission's website, which is www.psc.nd.gov. The hearing is being broadcast over the Internet and is also being electronically recorded. We ask anyone who'd like to comment to take the witness chair, which we're right in the middle right there, I think, is just fine, and speak into the microphone so the broadcast and recording will be of good quality. Let's see. Everyone will be given the opportunity to speak. If you have a prepared statement, we'd appreciate it if you provide a written copy for the file. You don't have to, but if you have it, we certainly like that. There's a sheet of paper that's written down there. Down being there on the table. For each of the cases, please sign in for which case you're interested. So unless there's anything that I've missed, I'll look at our general counsel. Alana, am I good here? Okay. We will now open the hearing for comments on the gas pipeline safety proposed rules, case number GS-14-761. Does anyone wish to testify for this case? And I see Patrick Fawn is already queued up, so Pat, as much as I'd like to swear in, I don't have the authority to do that. All right. No, Pat, go ahead and, for your record, all the who you are and what you have to say today.
My name is Patrick Fawn. I'm the Director of Compliance and Competitive Markets Division with the Public Service Commission. The Commission's Gas Pipeline Safety Program is one of the division's tasks. The purpose of my testimony is to explain the proposed changes to the Commission's administrative rules pertaining to adopting by reference in state administrative rule the most recent amendments to pipeline safety regulations adopted by the United States Department of Transportation Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which I'll call PHMSA in the rest of my testimony. I've passed out a copy of the proposed rule change. I have also included a copy of my testimony in written form, and attached to that is a summary or description of some of the rule changes related to PHMSA 49, Code of Federal Regulations, Part 192, and also Part 199, that these amendments, I guess I'll get into that in a moment. But so for the gas pipeline safety, this proposed rule change adopts rule amendments to safety regulations that have been adopted by PHMSA since June 22nd of 2011, and then up to November 6th of 2014. And as I mentioned, a description of those changes has been passed out. For the hazardous liquids pipeline safety, the Public Service Commission currently has statutory authority concerning that pipeline safety, but hasn't initiated a hazardous liquids safety program agreement with PHMSA. The Commission intends to initiate a safety program agreement with PHMSA in 2015, and is therefore adopting PHMSA hazardous liquids pipeline safety rules, which is Title 49, Code of Federal Regulations, Part 195. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Pat. The only question I have is just to clarify. I mean, everything we're doing today is just adopting the federal rule changes, which the companies have mostly done this. We're just updating the code, correct?
That's correct. We cannot adopt anything more stringent than the federal requirements, and we cannot adopt anything less stringent than the federal requirements, according to the agreement we have with them. So,
all right, thank you. Randy, you have any questions?
No questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak, Julie?
No questions.
All right. Patrick, anything else?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Pat. All right, does anyone else wish to testify on case number GS14761 concerning gas pipeline safety? I'm looking around the room once. Anyone else going twice? Anyone else going three times? All the comments made today and those provided in writing through December 26, 2014 will be considered and discussed in our decision. Also, any changes made to the proposed rule due to the Commission's review of comments received or the Commission's discussion will be explained in the written decision. The record will remain open until Friday, December 26th at 2014 at close of business. We'll now close the portion of the hearing concerning case number GS-14-761. I will now open the public hearing for comments on the procedural proposed rules, case number AD-14-762. Does anyone wishing to testify in case number AD-14-762 related to the procedural rules? Austin, you're already there. All right.
I am.
You can identify who you are and what you're here to tell us.
My name is Austin Lafferty. I'm a legal intern with the Public Service Commission's legal department. I'm here to talk about the proposed procedural rules before the commission, which create changes in four areas. I've worked with all four areas, and I may just have been an intern, but even I found them a bit difficult at times to work with, so these rules kind of streamline and change it to fit with the changing times and what the new policies are. These four areas are the service of formal complaints, individual customer notice and utility rate related cases, appearances at formal hearings, and protection of information. First, with the service of formal complaints under ND Administrative Code 69020202 and 03, the existing procedure for serving formal complaints is being clarified rather than changed by the proposed rules. The current language can be a bit ambiguous, and the proposed changes incorporate current practices to clarify that the complaint and notice of hearing may be served concurrently or they may be served separately. The proposed rule currently calls for both the complaint and notice of hearing to be served at least 45 days prior to the hearing date. However, upon further review of the standards set forth in North Dakota Century Code Section 283210, we recommend that the proposed rule be revised to require that only the complaint must be served at least 45 days before the hearing date. This change would allow the notice to be served with the complaint at least 45 days before the hearing or later than the complaint, so long as it is served as required by law, usually at least 20 days before the hearing. This proposed change is attached to this testimony for your review. The proposed rules also slightly alter when an answer to a complaint may be filed, changing it to 20 days from service of the complaint rather than from service of the complaint and notice of hearing. It is usually more efficient to serve the complaint alone first and then later schedule the hearing and issue notice after the parties have knowledge of the case and are able to provide input. The second issue is rate case bill stuffers, or ND Administrative Code 69020401. The existing rule lists several cases in which the applicant utility must provide individual notice of the application to customers. The proposed change adds one additional type of case, an advanced determination of prudence case, to this list. Advanced determination of prudence cases have rate-making consequences and thus should require individual customer notice. Current practices to require and provide individual customer notices in these types of cases due to the rate-making consequences, so the rule change should have no impact on industry, customers, the public, or other stakeholders. The third rule change is appearances at formal hearings, or ND Administrative Code 69020402. The existing rule requires that staff analysts who work on the case be noted in the appearances. At hearings, counsel indicates the staff working on the case, but the rule requires these staff members be listed in the appearances has been inconsistently followed and serves no discernible purpose. Repealing the language would have no impact on any stakeholder. The fourth and final proposed rule change deals with protection of information, or North Dakota Administrative Code Chapter 690209. The current rules provide the procedure to use when an applicant wants to protect information from disclosure under North Dakota's open records requirements. As written, the rules appear to apply only to requests regarding trade secret information, although they have been used when processing applications to protect other types of information as well. Since the writing of the existing rules, the legislature has added several additional open records exemptions beyond trade secret information. This chapter is being revised to reflect the existence of these additional exemptions and accommodate filings that may deserve protection under current state law, but would not be considered trade secret filings. Additionally, for certain telecommunication filings, case-by-case applications for protection and case-by-case processing will no longer be necessary, saving time and costs for both the telecommunications companies and for the state. To date, there is only one comment filed on the proposed rules, specifically for Chapter 690209, Protection of Information. This comment addressed two typographical errors that have been made. One is to add a new line item, 690209.13, to the list of sections at the beginning of the chapter, and the other to change a mistyped number in the new language added to Section 690209.12. This language should reference Section 13, not Section 14. These changes make the rules more versatile, more useful, more easily implemented, and clearer to those asking for protection for information, especially for information that is not strictly trade secret. These changes will have no negative impact on regulated industry, the Commission, the state, the public, or any other stakeholder. The only impact from these changes will be to make filing and processing of applications to protect information easier and more efficient for everyone involved. This concludes my testimony, and I can try to answer any questions as I am able.
All right. Thank you, Austin. The only one I wanted to clarify, question I'd have, is just more of a clarification. All this is about protecting the information of those that appear in front of us. It changes nothing with how our information at the PSC is treated, correct?
I'm going to have to defer to...
I just want to make it very clear that this has had nothing to do with our open records request or anything like that. It's all just those that appear before us.
Yes and no. This is Alana Jeffcoat Sacco, counsel. It will change... It will apply to every piece of information in the office, and it will change how something arrives at the status of being protected. Some things have statutory protection now. You don't have to jump through any hoops to get it, like a Social Security number. An internal one is governed by that. An external one is governed by that if somebody files it. So this will be used by people that appear, but it'll also be used by people that are simply submitting some information. We had something like this in insolvency settlement negotiations. So the procedure may have to be used if there's not a clear statutory process written down, but it isn't always for people that appear before us. It might just be for people doing business with us.
Got it. I just want to make it very clear, because you and I have had this discussion, that this has nothing to do if anybody wants information about Brian Kalk and what he's been up to. That's always the same.
It's always the same. But if they want your Social Security number, it's going to be protected.
Got it. Thank you, Austin. Thank you, Lana. Commissioner, any questions?
No.
Julie,
not
Commissioner?
For me.
Okay. Thank you, Austin.
I do have kind of an opening-type comment on the other one, though.
All right. I'll get to that in one second. Okay. Does anyone else wish to testify today in case number GS-14? Wait a minute. Does anyone else wish to testify today in case number AD-14-762? Anyone? Going once? Going twice? Okay. All the comments provided in writing through December 26, 2014 will be considered and discussed in our decision. Also, any changes made to the proposed rules due to the Commission's review of comments reviewed or the Commission's discussion will be explained in the written decision. The record will remain open until Friday, December 26, 2014. I will now close the portion of the hearing on AD-14-762. I will now open the public hearing for the comments on the licensed proposed rules case number GE-14-763. Before I turn it open to anyone to testify, I'll turn it over to the portfolio holder, who I believe has some comments.
Just kind of a note, because most of the people in the room appear to be interested primarily in this case, more so than the first two, with at least one exception probably. But as I sit through this, a couple things occurred to me that might seem odd about how we carry out this process. And so just by way of a little explanation, this is the first rulemaking hearing we've had now in the 23 and a half months that I've been here. So it's a little bit new to me, too. But I want to point out, we can't just change these rules. There's this process. We have this hearing. And when we talked earlier about building a record, kind of the point of why we're building a record is, if we get done with this and feel there should be some changes, we approve that, and then it goes to the attorney. And I'm glad Alana got back in the room so she can correct me if I'm wrong, since this is my first one. We forward this to the Attorney General's office. They have a look at it. It ultimately goes to the Legislative Audit and Fiscal Review Committee, and they will have a look at it, and that is where our record is important as to what we're doing and why we're doing it. So this is a step in a process, not just the end of it. The second thing I wanted to point out, why we bring you in here and have you sit through 21 minutes of other cases that you probably aren't interested in, we need to advertise these in official publications, and that comes at a cost to the taxpayers. And so when we knew we had several different areas where there are changes to be proposed, we brought them into one hearing so that when we're done and adopt whatever it is we ultimately adopt, we advertise them in one advertisement and save the taxpayers some money. So that's why there's three things going on today.
Anything else, Commissioner?
That's it.
Julie, do you have anything?
No.
Okay. Is there anyone wishing to testify on case number GE14-763? Sue, I see you're here. Go ahead, if you could identify yourself, and we're happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Sue Richter. I'm the Public Service Commission's Licensing Division Director. The Licensing Division is directly responsible for the licensing and regulation of grain elevators and grain buyers in North Dakota. The Commission is proposing amendments to change the way grain warehouse and grain buyer bonds are determined. The reason for this rulemaking is twofold. First, the last rulemaking revising bond requirements was in 1999. Since 1999, there have been 16 insolvencies with payments to non-credit sale contract, also referred to as cash, claimants of less than 10% in three failures, 31 to 43% in two failures, 62 to 72% in two failures, and 93 to 100% in eight failures. For one failure, the Commission didn't make payment because claims were withdrawn. For one failure, or the three insolvencies in which claimants received less than 10% of their valid cash claims involved a roving grain buyer and two processing grain warehouse facilities. Only one of the 16 insolvencies involved a facility-based grain buyer. 11 of the 16 insolvencies involved entities that were licensed less than 7 years. Over the years, the Commission has considered the issue of grain bond levels and the impact of the bonding requirements on recovery in the event of insolvency. In 2008 and 2009, the Public Service Commission met with various members of the agriculture community and interested legislators to discuss whether current bonds were inadequate, whether bonds should be increased, whether a new processor class should be created, or whether bonds should remain as is. Those bond discussions have been ongoing. The second reason for this rulemaking is in response to an audit by the North Dakota Office of the State Auditor of the Public Service Commission for the biennium ended June 30, 2013. The report issued by the State Auditor included a recommendation that the Commission take steps to increase grain buyer bonds. The Commission is proposing these rules to address the Commission's bonding concerns as well as those that recommendation by the State Auditor. Grain warehouse bonds are set forth in North Dakota Administrative Code Section 6907.0202. These current levels have been in place since August 1999 and equal approximately 50% per bushel for a licensee with a capacity up to 500,000 bushels plus 20 cents per bushel for each bushel over 500,000 bushels. The bond levels prior to the 1999 rulemaking were $1 per bushel for a licensee with a capacity up to 500,000 bushels, plus 20 cents per bushel for each bushel over 500,000. The proposed reduction in 1999 was due in part to a huge shift in marketing practices, a shift away from cash to credit sale transactions, which are not protected under a grain warehouse or grain buyer bond if a licensee becomes insolvent. This shift away from cash transactions to credit sale contract transactions means there are far fewer bushels that are eligible for protection under bonds. In 1999, staff estimated credit sale contract transactions were as high as 60% of a grain warehouseman's business, and based on information obtained during grain warehouse examinations, staff estimates today's use of credit sale contract transactions may be as high as 65 to 70% of a licensee's business. A credit sale contract indemnity fund was created by the 2003 legislature to provide partial protection for unpaid credit sale contract transactions in grain elevator and grain buyer insolvencies, which was not available back in 1999. There was no protection available to claimants with valid credit sale contract transactions prior to the indemnity fund in 2003. The commission is proposing rules that will change the way a grain warehouse bond is determined, including requiring 30% additional bond coverage for newer licensees licensed less than 7 years, and additional bond coverage for licensees with substantial annual grain purchase volume. Since the 1999 rulemaking, approximately 69% of the failures occurred during the first 7 years of business. This supports the requirement of additional bond for new licensees. The commission is proposing rules that will provide a reduction in the required bond for a licensee that establishes and follows a shorter scale ticket conversion policy approved by the commission. Under North Dakota Century Code Section 600211, a grain warehouseman must issue a scale ticket for each load of grain received, and all scale tickets must be converted into cash, warehouse receipt, or credit sale contract within 45 days after the grain is delivered. In the event of failure, the untimely conversion of scale tickets creates a greater risk to the farmer. When a scale ticket is converted in a shorter period of time, the risk to a farmer decreases and less bond may be needed. Larger liabilities may be associated with insolvencies of licensees that purchase larger volumes of grain. Because of this increased risk, the commission is proposing rules that will require additional bond to help alleviate some of the risk. A grain warehouse licensee with an annual purchase volume of more than 7 times its license capacity must file additional bond of 20 cents per bushel for each bushel that exceeds this amount. A licensee that handles a smaller volume of grain has a smaller risk and is not required to file additional bond. Facility-based grain buyer and roving grain buyers are set forth in North Dakota Administrative Code Section 6907.02-02.1. These bonding requirements were changed in August 1999, amended in August 2000, and have been in place ever since. A facility-based grain buyer is a grain buyer who operates a facility under the United States Warehouse Act, referred to as a USWA, and those storage obligations are governed by the USWA license. Only the cash and credit sale contract transactions of a facility-based grain buyer are governed by North Dakota law. A roving grain buyer is a grain buyer who does not operate a facility in North Dakota where grain is received. Currently, the bond for a facility-based grain buyer and a roving grain buyer is determined by the 3-year rolling average of grain purchased annually in North Dakota by the licensee. The bond amounts are 50 cents per bushel for the first 100,000 bushels, plus 20 cents per bushel for each bushel over 100,000 and up to 1 million bushels, plus 5 cents per bushel for each bushel in excess of 1 million. For a new licensee, the first year's bond is based on the projected grain purchase volume, and the second year, third year, and subsequent bonds are based on the average actual volume. The proposed rules do not change the way a bond for a facility-based grain buyer is determined. However, they do change the way the bond for a roving grain buyer is determined. A roving grain buyer bond will be based on the total projected annual grain purchase volume at a rate of 50 cents per bushel for the first 500,000 bushels, plus 20 cents per bushel for each bushel in excess of 500,000. The proposed rules will also increase the maximum required bond for all licensees. Currently, the maximum bond for a grain warehouse man and a roving grain buyer is $1,500,000, and the maximum bond for a facility-based grain buyer is $1 million. The maximum required bond for all licensees will be increased to $2 million under these proposed rules. The $50,000 minimum bond for all licensees will not change. The commission may require an increase in the amount of any bond when necessary to accomplish the purpose of North Dakota Century Code Chapter 6002 and Chapter 6002.1. Farmers will benefit from these proposed rules in the event a licensee becomes insolvent, since there should be more bond available to distribute to unpaid cash claimants. Staff created a PowerPoint presentation outlining the current and proposed bonding requirements. Also included was an example using the proposed rules to calculate a grain warehouse bond based on capacity, years licensed, a large annual grain purchase volume, and bond credit for a shorter scale ticket conversion policy. Attached to my testimony are those relevant pages. This concludes my testimony, and I'll try to respond to any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you, Sue. Before I forget, I just want to thank you for your work in this testimony, and I see Tim and Mike over there as well. Just publicly thank the three of you and Shelley, too, of course. You all do a very, very good job, and as we go through these proposed changes, no way infer that because we're not doing good work out there. You guys do really good work. It's just the situation has changed over time, and we're just going through the perhaps a review of it. The only question that I had, Sue, was that actually two. I recall the 2008-09 meetings that we had with all the different grower groups that no one, with the exception of the corn growers, was interested at that time of even touching the bond level. That's what I remembered. I was just curious if you remember it differently or anything jumps out at those meetings we had in 2008 and 2009. I wasn't part of 8, but I was part of 9.
Chairman Culk, you are correct. There were, I believe, four or five different entities or individuals that submitted language at that time, but I don't recall a request by any of those parties to increase the bond. The concern always is if you change it, you may end up with an unintended consequence.
Right, and as a follow-up to that, the only question I had was, is it, should we be concerned that if we get too, if the state bond makes too aggressive of changes, that we'll just push folks over to federal bonds? And then have lose all control over what goes on out there.
Commissioner Culk, I suppose hypothetically, if the bonds were too aggressive, it might make people take a look at the alternative license of the USWA. Even though they have to file a bond in order to get that license, they still have to apply for that facility-based grain buyer bond. So ultimately, depending on what the amounts of the bonds are, it may or may not make a difference.
Okay. Thank you, Sue. That was the only questions I had. Commissioner Christman?
You mentioned early on the audit that we received, and it was for the period ending June 30th of 2013. Do you recall about when we received that audit, when it became public and that we got it?
Commissioner Christman, I'm thinking back. I'm thinking maybe in around May of 2014. I don't remember exactly. I just remember at that time working on some language.
There's, I think, some initial discussions, but there's about like July of 2014 when we actually got the audit released to the committee. Sound about right?
Commissioner, I actually didn't see a copy of that final report, so I'm not positive, but I did review it.
Let's say this way. Was it in the summer sometime of 2014?
When the final audit report came out? That could be correct.
Okay. My point is that hasn't been lingering around here for a year and a half. I thought that might be the perception with
no.
the 2013.
No,
it was for that period, but it took almost a year till we got that audit.
Work, I believe, was started on this quite quickly after that initial audit report was.
And then going back to, you know, over the years, the discussions when it's cropped up, like especially in 2008 and 2009 of increasing bonds, was the discussion usually around like pretty just general increases, like similar to the decrease that took place in 1999, where like the first levels went from $1 to 50 cents? And, you know, do you think that's significantly different from this more more detailed approach of seeking to not have a real broad-based increase, but just looking at increases in the situations that actually seem to indicate the most risk or the most liability?
Commissioner, as I recall, I don't believe that there were any specific amounts that were identified. The discussions that I recall were in regard to how you increase the bond or some type of a protection so that there is more available when there's a failure to the companies that are especially the highest risk. One of the discussions was, should we create a category or a special bond for processors, because that's where you see a lot of the risk at the processors, because they handle such a large volume of grain generally.
You kind of foreshadowed my next question, but so that discussion has taken place, and it's proven kind of problematic to come up with really a definition of processors that different groups and individuals agree on?
That's correct, Commissioner.
Okay, and lastly, would you characterize this proposal as aiming toward limiting the increases to the types of facilities that statistically have the most risk or the most liability?
I would agree with you, Commissioner, on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else, Commissioner? No. All right. Commissioner Fedorchak, anything?
Don't have any questions for Sue.
Okay, Sue, so anything that you forgot to add after you had a chance to regroup a bit after your testimony? Anything else?
Nope, I have nothing else to add.
All right, thank you, Sue.
I guess one, except there are copies over at that south end of the table if anybody wants.
All right, thank you, Sue. All right, what I'll do now is we'll switch. If there's anyone else from the public that wishes to come up, please come on up to the center desk there. Make sure the green light is on and tell us your thoughts. This is kind of, Commissioner Crisman talked about this is the first time they've done this hearing. I've done these hearings before, but quite honestly, this is the first time we've had the public actually show up to them. And so it's true. So I guess the way this would lay out is that speaking for myself, if you have particular concerns about what we have, it'd be great if you tell us what your concerns are. And then if you have a specific recommendation that you think, you know, we like A, but we don't like B, and B should be changed, so give us something to work with. Because what we'll do is we'll take all of this and we'll probably go back and tweak it a little bit. But this is not really intended for you to say, why did you do this or why did you do that? Now, Randy may want to engage on that a little bit more than I would, because he worked a lot of it. But that's kind of my setup for my thoughts. Randy and Julie, what's your expectation, I guess?
I agree with you completely.
Julie, do you have anything that you wanted to add to that?
What are you trying to say? This isn't a give and take, or what?
I'm trying to say that this is what I'd like to see from the testimony is that we if we like it the way it is, that's great. If you don't like it, what your recommendation would be. And if you start asking questions about why did you pick this and that, we may be able to get into that discussion, but we don't want this to spiral into a back-and-forth discussion of it should be 6 cents, it should be 9 cents, it should be 12 cents. Tell us what you don't like, what it should be, and then we may interject back and forth. I guess I'm just trying to set some parameters around it.
Sure.
Okay. All right, well, anything else, my colleagues? All right, if you could first witness there, if you could give us your name, who you represent, and we're happy to hear your testimony.
Good afternoon. Chairman Kolk, Commissioners Crisman and Fedorchak. My name is Randy Melvin. I'm a fourth-generation farmer from Buffalo, North Dakota in Cass County. I currently serve as the Public Policy Committee Chairman for the North Dakota Corn Growers Association, which represents over 1,300 members across our state. I appreciate the opportunity to give input on behalf of our organization as to why changes to our bonding laws are necessary. The North Dakota Corn Growers Association supports improvements to our bonding laws in order to better protect farmers in the case of financial defaults. On August 21st, 2009, the corn growers and a number of other organizations submitted testimony on the structure of bond levels in North Dakota. At that point in time, the corn growers were convinced that our capacity-based system of bonds was outdated. We stated in a letter dated September 30th, 2009, that the commission should consider financial value versus physical storage capacity as a mechanism for issuing bonds. There were no changes that came out of the 2009 hearings. In 2013 to 2014, we co-funded a study along with the North Dakota Soybean Growers Association and the U.S. Durum Growers Association. This study by Dr. William Wilson and Bruce Dahl of the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University, entitled Risk Exposure of Financial Failure for North Dakota Grain Handling, was concluded in October of 2014. The report documents the risks to growers and the mechanisms used to mitigate risks related to buyer default. Along with our testimony here today, we wish to place a copy of this report into the public record. The report contains five sections, with recommendations on page 24. Dr. Wilson compiled a detailed analysis of mechanisms our state and others offer to protect farmers. At the heart of the matter is market volatility. Dr. Wilson's work suggests that volatility, as conventionally measured, has increased from about 0.18 in the early 1980s to about 0.4 or more in recent years. This increase is due to a change in commodity price levels and the increased cost and value of inputs, notably fertilizer. Other key points in the study are an evaluation of how volumes handled by individual shippers have increased, and a simulation model or stress test ranking the most to least important factors that would contribute to financial stresses. In 2000 to 2001, 100 car shippers were 9% of total grain handling capacity. In 2012 to 2013, these facilities accounted for 44% of total grain capacity. Clearly, we have seen more concentration in the last 12-year period. Rather than reading the report in its entirety, I would like to focus on the recommendations on page 24 and summarize them. Recommendations for further review and or analysis. The purpose of this study was to identify the changes and relevant risks that confront grain and oilseed producers in North Dakota and to assess the adequacy of mechanisms designed to mitigate these risks. The intent was not to prescribe specific changes, but rather to identify those areas worthy of consideration for legislative changes to assure protections for growers. It appears that the most important considerations for North Dakota include, number one, increasing the maximum payment from the indemnity fund. Currently, the fund pays 80% of the claims, up to $280,000 per producer. Given the increase in producer size, production, and market volatility, this value is probably inadequate. Indeed, given market parameters, the maximum would have to increase to provide equivalent coverage as originally intended by this mechanism. Allow me to add to this point. In 1991, estimated gross receipts per farm were $100,000. In 2012, that number was $803,351. Number two, there are several recent insolvencies that could potentially lower the indemnity fund balance to near $3.6 million, which is much less than earlier minimum levels at which assessments would be reimposed. Number three, reevaluating the structure of the mechanisms. Alternatives include considering value of the commodity. Currently, the mechanism in North Dakota are based on storage capacity or sales. Whether to use indemnity funds or bonding or to use both. Currently, North Dakota is one of few states that use both methods. Adding net worth requirements. Typically, minimum net worth requirements are imposed and additional bond is required to make up the difference for shortfalls. The relationships between claims and indemnity fund, minimum or maximum, suggest that if average payouts for claims increase, then minimums and maximums for the indemnity fund would likely need to increase to be consistent with other states. Number four, dry beans. This crop has greater risks than other crops. Other states' bonding requirements for dry beans are much greater than those in North Dakota. In conclusion, the North Dakota Corn Growers Association will go on record as supporting a thorough review of North Dakota's current bonding structure. We view the study Risk Exposure of Financial Failure for North Dakota Grain Handling as good analysis. We believe this will help enhance the dialogue for the Public Service Commission to make the most beneficial changes. We thank the Commission for your attention to this issue of improving farmer protections. I would be happy to answer any questions, but would defer any technical questions on this study to Dr. William Wilson to accurately answer.
Well, thank you, Randy. Very good. Our attorney just walked out here. Daryl, you're in charge then. Can you make sure all these things that we get, Randy's testimony as well as this, we get those docketed and make sure we track all this? So Daryl can be our official collector of these items. So did you get a copy of his testimony? And you got a copy of the...
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
And we do have some more copies back here also of it, if anybody else would like to see a copy of it.
Super, Randy. Okay, so thank you. I just have a couple questions, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues. You referenced the 2009. There was a lot of discussion, but it never moved anywhere. Do you know why it didn't move anywhere in 2009?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know for sure. I was not on the North Dakota Corn Growers in 2009. I've only been on it for a couple of years. I could defer that question to our executive director or Mike Clements, who were on the Corn Growers at that time.
Maybe I'll take it a step farther. I remember it because couldn't get anybody behind it besides you guys, is about what it came down to. And so what I guess is kind of a lead up to this one is that this is a great study you have, but what are the feelings that you get from, the two farm groups, the big ones, not that you guys aren't all big, but, Farmers Union and Farm Bureau, it seems like getting their viewpoints on things, it's hard. If they agree on something, it seems like things move, and it seems like the other folks don't seem to be engaging on that. Do you have any other folks that are with you on this kind of this study, any other groups?
The groups that were involved with us on the study were the North Dakota Soybean Growers Association and the U.S. Durum Growers Association.
So we could consider those groups in the same positions?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yep. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And then do you have any particular comments about, the bonding level changes that we put in there where, X amount for the first 6 years? If you're one category, you get a certain bond rate. Do you have anything particular on what we've got in table now?
Mr. Chairman, right now, the stance of the North Dakota Corn Growers is that we do support these changes that you have laid out. From what we understand them as of today and what we have evaluated them, we are in support of those changes.
But you'd like to see additional things as you laid out in the study on 24?
This study done by Dr. Wilson were just some changes that could be done. These are ideas that we want to bring forward as dialogue for you, the Public Service Commission, to bring forward.
And then I'll turn it over to Randy here in one sec. But speaking for myself, I think when we sit down, we'll look at these if there's ways to incorporate it into the rule, perhaps. But I would also say that as we get into this next session, if there's a bill that you would bring forward in some of these areas, the way it lays out with the commission, we all three get together and we may have a commission position on it. We may not all three agree, but one of us might come down there and testify for it. For me personally, there's some really good ideas here. So if you do end up bringing some bills forward, I think that we could certainly have some discussion about ways to help out in that process, speaking for myself. So that's the only questions I have and comments. Thank you. I'll see if Commissioner Christman has any.
A few of them. And one of the things that you addressed specifically in your recommendation number one, but then like in at least one of the subsections in number three, you kind of alluded to it, is the indemnity fund. It's important, I think, to point out that the indemnity fund is created and the kind of the guidelines for it are all in the law. So we can't change that by a rule. That's something the legislature has to do. So those parts of your recommendations are completely out of our ability to address in a rulemaking. So I guess this should be questions. So do you agree with that?
Commissioner, I do agree with that. And I think, I can't say 100% for sure what Dr. Wilson, but I believe he was taking a look at the overview of the whole industry and just looking at every aspect of it and what can be done, and not so much necessarily just on this bonding requirement, but the whole risk of, financial defaults and for improving farmer protections. And that's why he's looking at it. And we just want to submit this as on the record for information to open up the dialogue.
Appreciate it, because there's some good information here. I look forward to going through the whole thing some more. In subsection 3, you mentioned value of commodities. And, in this rulemaking process, so we worked on these, and and issued a notice that we were going to have this meeting. And then, as I talked earlier, it ends up going to the Attorney General's office and then to a Legislative Audit and Fiscal Review Committee, and they meet quarterly. So the whole time that this can take can be off by a couple months, depending on exactly when you start it and how their quarterly meetings go. But, you know, it's, I don't know, probably a 5 to 8 month process or something like that. And so it's one of the difficulties in chasing commodity prices. By the time we make a rule change, because something is down, by the time we get the rule changed, it might be up. And so I want to point that out. You mentioned in here also in number three, adding net worth requirements. And that an additional bond required to make up for difference in net worth requirements. So would you say that the proposal to require the additional 30% bond on operators in their first years of operation, when their net worth would probably in many cases be less than later on when they're more established, do you think we kind of hit that point pretty well?
Mr. I do believe you are making a good move in the right direction. Yes, I do agree with it.
And then lastly, I'm intrigued by your comments on the beans, and that's really been something, I guess, kind of since we started moving down this path, that's especially in discussing with Sue and Tim and Mike more, you know, and looking at past insolvencies, and it's not really addressed here to separate that commodity out, but I understand some states do and have different rules, so appreciate the information. It might be something to look at more in the future, but it's an interesting point. I don't have any other questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Thank you, Randy. Appreciate your testimony. I'm interested if you have anything more specific you can speak to on the actual changes that we propose and how far these go to address your big concerns, because, you know, there are some proposals here to deal more on volume and to address some of what you're saying here, but your testimony doesn't relate real well to our proposed rules. And I'd like to get a little bit more clarity on where we're falling short, where you think we should be doing more or less, or, you know, that type of thing in terms of what's actually proposed.
Commissioner, the part here that I was talking about, these 4 points, were taken directly out of Dr. Wilson's study that we co-funded. And we brought this forward and put this in the record basically as information for the Public Service Commission to have and to help evaluate where we're at in this process. As far as corn growers, as we looked at what the changes you've made so far, the bonding requirements, we are comfortable with the changes you have made. And I apologize if I wasn't clear in my testimony in that, but we do agree with your changes in the current form. And we can go back and submit testimony before the 26th if you like, and to reiterate some different changes there, or, you know, if that's what you're looking for, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't know if there'll be other commodity groups who come forward and comment on this or not, but the more specific you can be in terms of, you know, what's proposed and how far it goes to addressing your biggest concerns, that would be very helpful. And if you can do that by letter, I think that would be great for our benefit, because I'm sure there's going to be some who maybe don't support what we're doing. So to know where, you know, where we, how we kind of get to the middle point that works would be good. Thanks.
We will do. Thank you.
Anything else, Julie?
Nope.
Randy, I'd heard about this study being done. Did you know if your organization ever briefed it out to the ag committees downstairs or the governor's office, or what were you able to do with this thing? Just out of curiosity.
The study is concluded in October, and I don't believe we have gotten out to anybody else yet. We brought it today to put in the record, and our intent was to bring it to the ag commissioner and possibly the governor in the future here, but we just have not gotten to that yet.
Okay, because I think Julie's points are right on, is that it'd really be great if we could hear specifically what you like and don't like about the rules in front of us right now, because that's the shark closest to the canoe. But I'd be certainly interested in helping you as you shop this around for those other things, because a lot of people put a lot of work into this, and my general concerns are still the same. If the state gets so aggressive, you push them over to the feds, and we create things we didn't know we thought through all the way through by doing some of this stuff, and it's like herding cats when it comes to this kind of stuff. And so studies like this really help out, but then we have to do something with them. So I'd be curious, anything we could do to help out there, I think we'd be interested in doing that. So.
And maybe we could have a separate even discussion with your group to go through the study and, walk through it.
I think that's
more
a great
depth,
idea.
And we can have a give and take in that respect as well.
You could talk to Daryl afterwards and maybe find some times that work for all of you and come back and do just a presentation to us just on this. Mm-hmm. That'd be great. Because then if we do end up getting some bills out of this to go to the legislator, like Randy talked about, some of this is outside our rules, then we could weigh in what we think on it. That'd be great. Okay, going once, going twice, Commissioner Christman.
Good.
Commissioner Fedorchak. All right, thank you all, Randy.
Thank you.
Alana, just so you know, I asked Daryl just to collect all the testimony from those if they have presented, as well as the study, and then you can hang on to that. Okay. Anyone else wish to testify in this particular case in front of us?
Good afternoon, Commissioners.
Good afternoon.
My name is David Fiebiger. I'm the president of the North Dakota Graineries Association, which represents 90% of the licensed grain and feed warehouses in North Dakota. Our organization was founded in 1911. Our purpose is to further the interests of the cooperative and independent elevators and their concerns in North Dakota, engaged in the handling, processing, distribution of grain and other like commodities. We have worked closely with the PSC in the past years towards the same goal, which is a healthy industry serving its customers with honesty and integrity. With that goal in mind, we offer the following points regarding the proposed license changes. The proposed changes would remove the current capacity bans and increase the amount of bond required on facilities in the first 6 years of operation. We understand the reason for proposing more bonding on companies that have been in business for a shorter amount of time and don't necessarily see a problem with it, but removing the 25,000 bushel bans could pose a problem for bond agencies and facilities alike. Any increase in capacity will require a new bond, regardless of the size of capacity change. We suggest keeping the current bans while still implementing a percentage increase for companies that fall into the 1 to 6 year category. One question that this would rise or ask is, what about a joint venture between two established companies? Would increased bonding be required for that? The proposed rules would require additional bonding for those facilities that have a purchase volume greater than 7 times the storage capacity. Once again, we understand the reasoning for additional bonding. Most of those types of facilities are engaged in some type of processing, but we would rather see a measure that addresses processors specifically. This rule could unintentionally penalize some elevators, and some of those might be very financially strong in the grain industry. The proposed rules would offer a bond reduction for those facilities willing to implement a conversion policy shorter than the 45 days currently in the law. We don't see this being implemented widely through the industry. Here's an example. An elevator that has a capacity of 1 million bushels would require a $350,000 bond. A 30% reduction due to the 10-day conversion policy would make that a $245,000 bond. The bond premium saving amounts to less than $800, which would not be enough of an incentive to implement a conversion policy at that elevator. Another factor to consider is who will be doing the checking for compliance and how much time would be involved for such a compliance check. The proposed rule changes would increase the amount of the maximum bond from 1.5 to 2 million. That may impact a few elevators. it probably wouldn't be a problem for those that it would impact. The proposed rule changes would increase the amount of bond required by roving grain buyers. We also don't see a problem with this requirement. That may not affect any of our members. In closing, as stated earlier, the North Dakota Granular Association wants a strong and healthy relationship with the PSC and the industry, and we'll support changes that will promote that, but we also believe that the system we have in place works. We do suggest a couple of the tweaks or agree with some of them, but overall, the current system works. If you have any questions, I can take them now.
Thank you, David. I guess I'll get right to the direct question. So do you feel our system right now is working, is pretty good, or it's not working at all?
For the licensed warehouses that we represent, you know, you have to understand that 90% of our membership is a facility-based grain buyer. For our membership, yes, it works very well.
Yeah, I remember the discussion with, I think it was David sitting in that desk a few years ago, and he said, listen, we've got good managers, leave us alone. And that's, I don't disagree with that statement. I think you said you agree with some of it. Can you highlight again which areas you like the best? If we were to tweak this, what you think is the changes that we should be looking at?
Implementing the percentage increase for companies that fall into that 1 to 6 year category.
But leave the bands the way they are.
Leave the bands the way they are, that's right.
Okay.
The bands might create it so that, you know, any time that you increase the capacity, now you have to go get a new bond, no matter what the increase of capacity is, whether it's 10 bushels or 10,000 bushel capacity.
Okay. And then there's another piece of this you do like better than others? The jump set, I thought there was two things, or was that the second one?
The second one is the additional bonding for the facilities that have purchase volume greater than 7 times the storage capacity. We like that because it looks like and it sounds like it's kind of aimed towards a processor or geared towards processors.
Okay.
However, when you have elevators that are very financially sound, that might affect them as well because they're handling an enormous bushel volume.
Okay. Would you have a recommendation of how we deal with two existing companies that form a joint venture, how you could treat them the same, even though it's a new company?
Probably on a case-by-case basis. You know, I think that's something that probably has to go up for, you know, the frequency that happens, I can't speak for.
Okay, looks like Stu might have some thoughts, too. If you do, Stu, that's great, but maybe join him up there in the mic and... Because I don't want to go on this road too far, but this is also our chance to get some feedback of, if that's okay with you too.
Mm-hmm. Stu Letcher with the North Dakota Grain Dealers Association. One thing you could look at is if you're going to have a joint venture between two established grain companies, they're each also going to be required to be bonded. And, you know, you could look at what bond they're required if they're both, you know, in that past the 1 to 6 year, maybe you require the bonding for the new company. You know, you allow that to go at the lower bonding rate.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
That would be one idea.
Okay. I don't have any other questions for you, gentlemen. I'll see if Commissioner Chrisman does. Since, Stu, you joined the fight, now you're in.
Talk to me more about the bans and the negative impact. Or they're not using the bands anymore and just doing it per bushel.
Sure.
That's probably more of a bond agency perspective, which, you know, we're a licensed agency and I'm a licensed agent. Having those 25,000 bushel bands allows you some flexibility with your capacity and still be covered under the current bond. We see it pretty regularly where you might have a company add or subtract a smaller bin, and we get notice of that change. But if it doesn't, doesn't fall outside that 25,000 bushel band, we aren't required to get a new bond. Whereas going to just a straight per bushel charge, any capacity change, mainly increases, would require a new bond. And that's a pretty lengthy paperwork process to do that. And a lot of the underwriting companies will charge a $100 fee for each bond change. So that's going to be a cost that's going to be passed back to the elevator. So we do quite a bit of them now with riders for ground storage. And, you know, if it requires a change in the bond, of course, then we write a new bond or we get a rider for the bond. But, you know, if we could, those bands do help with some of that paperwork.
But, so with 25,000 bushel increments, unless someone was like right at the top or bottom of one and had an addition or subtraction that was just 25,000 or less, they would always switch different bands anyway. Do you really have a... So typically, I would guess that most times if it's going to be more than about a 15,000 bushel change, they're probably going to jump bands. So do you have a lot of additions or subtractions to storage capacity in that small of increments anymore?
Actually, we do see. I mean, it could even amount to a warehouse examination where the capacity ends up a few bushels different from one examination to another. Well, going by a per bushel basis, you've got to change the bond, especially in the case of an increase, not necessarily if it's a decrease, because obviously you can carry more bond than what's required by law. But if, you know, you have something as small as a 500 bushel difference, you are, according to the way the rules are written, you would be required to get a new bond. And that process is pretty lengthy.
Okay.
So we don't necessarily have a problem with increasing the amount. We would just like to see those 25,000 bushel bands stay in the rule.
And what did you say about the discount for a quicker conversion agreement? You didn't think that too many people...
I don't think too many elevators would take you up on that. You know, I mean, you're going to save $800 and you're going to have to start doing those conversions rather than once every 45 days. Now you're doing once every 10. So in order to save $800 over the course of the year, in theory, you're quadrupling your workload in order to save $800. Because now, rather than transferring every 45 days, you have to do every 10.
Okay.
And on top of that, your inspectors, you know, how is that going to work with your inspection process? Now you're going to have your inspectors at elevators every 2 weeks to see if they're implementing that 10-day process. Or, you know, I think that you're...
I would guess the important thing will be when they are there, that there won't be any tickets older than what you agreed upon. So, do you have a good definition of processors that you think the industry would get behind?
I don't think we can come up with one today. I think we all have that idea in our mind, but when you try and put it down on paper, yeah. Commissioner, I think the verbiage is what muddies the waters.
Yeah. Okay, I don't have any other questions, but thanks.
Thank you, Randy. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
So I was interested in the same question as Randy on the processor. If what we're doing here is kind of aimed at processors, and it tell me how it affects your folks in a negative way without kind of, you know, in addition to maybe catching some of the processor group as well. How does it affect the folks in a negative way?
That's an excellent question. Today it might not, but 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, it very well could. We all know that elevators are getting larger, faster, bigger, stronger. And with the elimination of the smaller elevators, if that's the way that we continue to go, unfortunately, you may see more elevators that are handling seven times their capacity. So it might not affect us as much today, or it might affect a few of us, fewer of us today, than it will 5 years down the road. And that's what we have to be aware of, is what are these changes, who are they going to affect today, but also who are they going to affect down the road.
How big of a jump, this is something we've kind of had a hard time getting a handle on here, how much more does it cost a company to bond at these higher levels? I mean, is there a formula for the bond increment increases in
cost? I can give
you
rough estimates. To go from a $1.5 million max bond to a $2 million max bond is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $3,000 in bond premium
for the year.
For the year, for that bond
is how much?
$2,000 to $3,000. Okay. If they're currently carrying $1.5 million and it goes to, and they have to then increase to $2 million.
And then is it similar or is it exponential? If it goes like from 2 to 2.5, it's just significantly more. Is it just kind of the same
rate?
Similar
to the way you have it set up in the rule, as far as, you know, the first 100,000 and then the next 100,000 is you know, gets to be cheaper, and then as you get into the higher levels, it flattens out to a lesser amount.
Because I'm curious if the discount, you know, for operating, you know, with a quicker turnaround time isn't of interest, then I'm just wondering how big of a deal the higher bond premium is. You know, because that could cut it in half, you know, or almost reduce your cost. So that's just kind of, this is what I'm hearing from folks, you know, that we don't want to be onerous. We don't want to make it harder for you guys to do business, but we also need to understand how big a dollars we're talking here. If it's jump from $2,000 to $3,000 a year, how onerous is that for you guys to weather and for your members?
But then again, you're targeting the facility-based grain buyer and saying that, you know, when you look at Sue's testimony, you can clearly see that it is processors and it is companies that are within 1 to 7 years that seem to be the problem. I think we can all agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
So now what we're doing is we're asking the facility-based grain buyer, sure, that's been in business for 100 years and has no problems with insolvencies, for him to pick up the slack and mm-hmm. for him to mm-hmm. pay for that.
So how do we get at the processors? How do we find that definition? How do we narrow the group? You know, how do we do that?
One idea that we've toyed with, too, is looking at their total purchase as percentage of their license capacity. In the case of a lot of the processors, they're going to probably not have as much license capacity compared to their total purchase. You know, proportionately, an elevator is probably going to have more storage, just for the fact mm-hmm. that if you're loading shuttles, you're going to be required to have more storage,
sure,
than say a processor that might carry the minimum bond of $50,000, and, you know, process. Like the example in your testimony, Sue, was like $2.6 million. You know, if you're carrying a $50,000 bond, that means that, you know, they have a steady stream of grain coming, and you can tell just the proportion of how much they purchase compared to their storage capacity. You know, that might be one thing to look at.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate what you're saying in terms of penalizing the folks who are not causing the problem. And that's, we don't want to, you know, we want to avoid that while also trying to find a way to get at the volume issues of processors. So that ends my questions for you guys.
Commissioner Crispin, you got some follow-up?
I do, and not in a question, but I'd be curious of your response to this, because I feel like we're kind of, this is sort of evolving in a direction that isn't really my intent necessarily, that this is specifically aimed at processors. To me, the aim, as far as this seven times part of this package. The aim is to direct some increased bonding in areas that us as trustee, if one of them becomes insolvent, where we have the most potential liability. And the law on the conversions is 45 days. So I guess if you, and I know it's a extremely fluctuating industry, you take in a large part of your grain in harvest time, obviously, but if you average that out over the course of the year, there's 8 cycles in there. Well, if someone, whether it's a processor or a more traditional grain dealer, is having problems and becomes unable to pay but is still taking in grain and getting rid of it, it's going to be about 45 days till anyone has the basis to make a complaint to us, and that's when we even start looking into it. And so although most of the instances where we currently have these real high-volume dealers are processors, I'll acknowledge that, if anyone is turning their capacity over so frequently, whether they're processing it or that they just happen to be, and I don't know where you'd find this place, but somewhere where they have such good rail shipping or something that they can keep getting rid of it, in either event, in 45 days, they can run up an extraordinary amount of liability. And I have never meant this to specifically apply to or be aimed at processors, but to be aimed at the dealers that potentially run up the extraordinary amounts of liability for us as trustees if they would become insolvent. So I just want to point that out and be curious your response.
I guess I would go back to the point that an elevator is probably going to carry a larger bond in the first place, just because we're, you know, if you're loading a shuttle train, you're going to have a minimum amount of storage, and you're going to have a larger bond as compared to those. So, and would it be onerous? You asked, would it be onerous? I don't know that it would be onerous on any facility to add that additional $500,000 in bonding. You know, we're basically talking about going from $1.5 million to a max of two, or, you know, up to a max of two. So.
Okay. Anything else?
Nope.
Julie, anything else?
I don't think so. Thank you guys for being here.
I just had one closing thought that I've always been under the impression that, from your viewpoint, no amount of bond level is going to replace a good manager. If you have good managers, the bond almost becomes a secondary issue. And sometimes I feel like we're trying to get cute with all these bonds. When you got good people running the elevators, things work out fine. So that's all. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. Any other members of any particular groups or individuals would like to address the commission on this particular issue? All right, sir. You could, you know the drill at this point in time, right? David, did you want to present that as your testimony or your handed in?
Thank you.
Alana, how should we be? You'll sort that with Daryl, how we'd label these and all that?
Each set of comments will be docketed afterwards. We'll get that done.
All right.
We have copies.
Okay, I'm guessing this is Russell here. Russell, I'll turn it over to you then.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Kalk and Commissioners Chrisman and Fedorchak.
It's all right. It's a hard one.
Had trouble then.
Fedorchak.
Fedorchak.
You're not the first one to mispronounce it.
I've been trying to get it right all day.
Yours is definitely easier.
Thanks for my part. My name is Russell Dole. I'm a farmer from southwest North Dakota, specifically Reeder, and I'm chairman of the U.S. Durum Growers Association.
Good for you.
On behalf of the U.S. Durum Growers, I would like to voice support of the proposed amendments to the bond rules. The purpose of the U.S. Durum Growers is to promote the production and marketing of durum, wheat, and semolina, and lobby on domestic policy issues that affect the durum producer. Our mission is to increase the profitability of durum production through effective domestic policy development and promotion and coordinated communication and educational outreach. Recognizing the increasing value of commodities and volatility of markets, the U.S. Durum Growers partnered with the North Dakota Corn Growers Association and the North Dakota Soybean Growers Association to co-found a study by Dr. William Wilson and Bruce Dahl of the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University. The purpose of this study was to identify the changes in relevant risks that confront grain and oilseed producers in North Dakota and to assess the adequacy of mechanisms designed to mitigate these risks. The study found that the increase in commodity prices and the increased cost and value of inputs has led to an increase in volatility in recent years. Also, the estimated gross receipts per farm in 1991 were $100,000 compared to $803,351 in 2012. It is no secret that today's producers are facing much higher risks than ever before. The U.S. Durum Growers Association is supporting the proposed amendments to the bond rules as it will provide additional protection for durum producers in our nation's number one durum producing state, North Dakota. Based on conversations with local elevators, U.S. Durum Growers understands that the proposed changes would not be significantly cost prohibitive for elevators that the revisions specifically target those facilities with the most liability and vulnerability. In a time when high-priced commodities and volatile markets place extreme risk on producers, our organization recognizes the proposed rules as a step in the right direction toward better protecting grain producers. Do you have any questions?
Oh, thank you, Russell. We always got questions, right? So you're chairman of the whole U.S. Durum Grower Association, the whole darn country?
That's right. See, North Dakota has most of the durum, sure. About 60%.
Yeah, but the titles don't say that. Just say you're darn right. Right?
Yeah, it sounds like a big title, but it's not that much.
Well, I was a top 10 in my class. I don't tell them there's only 8 kids. So, I mean, I just have one. Maybe just give me some of your perspective, Russell. So you're telling me that the cost has gone from $100,000 in 1991 to $800,000 roughly a decade later, that big of an increase in what it costs to put a crop in and out?
That's the gross receipts.
So what's, I mean, that's, why?
It does. Does it cost that much more? Yeah, I believe it.
I'm just trying to get a perspective of that number. How in the heck can we cover bonds to cover?
Well, it roughly costs, for wheat produce $150 an acre to put that crop in, including someone said before, your fertilizer and chemicals have gone up a tremendous amount in the last 15 years.
Okay.
I think that's where the two biggest costs are. Then you have your land equipment has gone up. A combine used to cost, when I first started farming in 1977, I bought a 760 Massey combine for $45,000. A new combine now costs, I bought a new S680 John Deere a year ago with a new corn head and a new 40-foot header. That combine listed for $750,000. So, the costs have tremendously gone up. And we're going to be in big trouble if the commodity prices keep dropping like they are. But getting back to risk, I talk to
that's what I'm trying to, managers. We get a lot of chances to talk to people, but getting folks with your background, all of you up here, it doesn't happen that much for us. But, how can we – how do I explain this one? What avenues are at your disposal besides the bonds to protect yourself from these volatility swings? Like, let's say we leave the bonds the way they are. Or let's say we change them either way, but there's still an amount of risk that you have to protect yourself from. I'm just curious how you do that.
Well, in my case, I go by the people you're dealing with. We got one company right now that sells chemicals and fertilizer, and you hear a lot of bad stories that they're going to become insolvent. Okay, last year I paid that company $400,000 prepay. They want everything prepay, for your fertilizer and chemicals. Okay, I'm really reluctant this year. I don't think I'm going to prepay that company, because
So reduce your
exposure. If they do go insolvent, how am I going to get it back? And I give them $300,000 or $400,000, then they don't deliver the fertilizer and chemical, and I got to go buy it someplace else. That's going to cost me $800,000. I don't know if I can afford all that. You know, so you got to deal with a reputable company. And nowadays, how reputable are they? One elevator manager just said, well, he lost $800,000 on one unit train because of these big discounts that we got. You know, falling numbers, like Southwest Grain out there on their wheat. If your falling numbers on your wheat gets below 275, it's feed wheat. So you lose about $3, $4 a bushel. Durum, I sold Durum for $12 a bushel. Now I got Durum in there I'm not going to get $5 a bushel for. So it's so volatile, you know, with us. But then, like I told another farmer, well, do you want the elevator to go broke? I don't. I said I'd rather lose some money than have the elevator go broke. But if they start losing $800,000 on one train load, how long are they going to be able to go? And they're well established. Yeah. So I think this bonding is needed. That's going to be a help. And the indemnity fund, we aren't going to talk about that too much. We know that goes to the legislature, but that needs to be increased. You look at 15 years, how the expenses and the risk is increased, you know, that this is just a Band-Aid, really, to the real problem. So you have to get extra bonding. You can get extra bonding on that grain if you're going to keep it in there. I know there's farmers that have grain in there. They got $1 million worth of deferred grain. If that company goes insolvent, there goes their retirement. So you have to buy some extra bonding. You can get extra bonding other than what, you know, through the elevators.
Got it. But the gist of your testimony I heard was you support the changes that are in front of us, but there's a lot of uncertainty in a lot of other areas that this doesn't address.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll see. Commissioner Crisp, anything from you?
I do, and appreciate you being here. I have to take either the credit or the blame, depending on the perspective, for the part specifically about changing from those 25,000 bushel bands where the current bonding requirements are, you know, it's so much at this level, and then go up another 20, and it's another, to just changing it per bushel. And my thought really was, you know, a producer that's just assuming that their local dealer is good, and you hear about these bands, and they're talking, well, I don't know if my elevator has 450,000 bushels of capacity or 700,000. Never thought about it. I don't know how big those bins are. But if it's laid out in a perspective of that it starts at 50 cents a bushel and goes down as they become larger, that maybe farmers would realize better that our main ability to make people whole is capturing the grain. The bond is just a little extra to work with. It's almost nothing per bushel, really. And so my question for you is, do farmers, do you think, really understand that this bond is just a little extra to go with whatever we can capture in grain? It's not really the main tool in making people whole if there is an insolvency?
Yeah, I think they do, but I don't know how to answer that specifically. I mean, I guess I haven't thought about it that much myself, and I guess if you worked with an insolvency, then maybe you'd think about it more. But I do realize it's a small amount that is, you know.
Okay. Well, thank you,
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Mr. Doe, it could be Doe or Doe, or it could be
whatever
it could be fits. Or something, you know, French.
I've been called a Doe. Reindeer and everything else. Oh, buck, whatever.
A couple questions. You hit on something that is a problem, and that is people get real familiar with this when there's an insolvency, and then they learn more about what is and isn't covered, and that's the unfortunate situation is I don't think a lot of farmers really look real closely at whether a, you know, 50,000 bond, or if that is just for their grain, or if that's to spread over everybody's, you know, sales. I think there's a lot of confusion out there. So to the degree that your organizations and the corn growers can educate your members, that's helpful too in terms of how they're protected and what the limitations of that protection are. So I just make that pitch to you. I'm curious on the conversion incentive that is included in this, where, you know, we're incentivizing the elevators to convert in 45 days or sooner to minimize the potential risk out there. We've heard a lot from the grain dealers that the farmers like the flexibility and don't really want to be restricted to those time frames, and that, you know, it's kind of a customer service tool that the elevators use in dealing with farmers. How do you see it as a, you know, representing producers, if the elevators are going to be, you know, incentivized or if we're going to start looking at enforcing those time periods more carefully and more closely as a producer? Do you recognize that that's to help minimize losses in the long run, or how do you think that how do you see that as a producer in terms of losing that flexibility and that tool?
Well, to tell you the truth, I guess I haven't really thought about it that much. You know, with everything, I guess you lose something, but I don't know, long-range thinking on most people, what they would really think about it.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you value, being able to go over that 45-day conversion?
Well, I think it's kind of, Commissioner, it's kind of like Commissioner Christman's talking about, you know, 45 days is a long time. You could turn a lot of stuff over and a lot of money could be lost. So I don't know.
So your group is supportive of that too, it sounds like. I mean, you said you're supportive of all of it, so that's included. And then one other question for you. Are there gaps in what we're doing here where you know, when you looked at it, thought, well, this is a good start, but they really need to do X, Y, and Z? Are there things missing that you feel like need to be considered or paid attention to here that aren't covered by this rule, recognizing the indemnity fund is separate and that more on the legislative side?
You mean in the bonding process?
Yeah, in what we've proposed here.
Well, I don't know. I suppose as far as the amounts, the cents per the bushel amounts, one thing that was mentioned, I think, before is net worth. Some other states do that. Where there's the net worth of the elevator is involved with it, the net worth of the organization. There's so many cents for the shortfall.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have that net worth would come in, and if it was there's a shortfall, they'd get more payment there, cents per bushel. Indemnity fund, 80%. Getting back to that, I think North Dakota pays 80%, a maximum of $280,000 to a producer. Some states are 80 to 100% on that. That might be a consideration. That's in that study.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at that study, but, you know, I haven't. I'm a newly elected president, so I'm a little more of a producer right now, so I haven't had a chance. I looked at it, but you know, when you look at it, and you got to study it, and there's a lot in there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know all the nuts and bolts, but that's two things that are in there, and there's a study in that study too. It tells what other states do, and I believe it was mentioned us in Oklahoma were the only two states where we had the indemnity fund and the bondy. Some states only have one of them. So we're a little ahead of the game then, but we are down at the 80% and the $280,000 limit, which can differ from other states. But I think someone mentioned, too, that study was, I think that's good, and we need to look at it close, and maybe we can gain more from it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. When we have our our presentation from the group, you're welcome to come, or you can listen to it online, too. We broadcast all of our meetings like that, so you could listen to it in your own tractor.
Okay. All right, Commissioner Crispin, any follow-up?
Nope.
So you said Reeder?
Right.
So you know that John Byers crowd and the Anderson family down there?
John Byers, yeah.
John and Jeff and all that crowd?
Yep, yep.
Great. All right, thanks.
He's a lawyer, attorney.
I know, A.W., the AG's office. Thank you, sir. All right, do we have anyone else that wishes to testify in the current case in front of us? Anyone else at all? And did we get a we got a copy of your thing, right, Russell? Good. Daryl, you got it from Russell?
I don't have Russell.
Here, take mine. You got one? Okay. Okay. Carry on, sir. I'm not sure which one you are for sure. We visited briefly.
Chairman, commissioners, for the record, my name is Jeff Suger. I'm the chairman of the North Dakota Ethanol Council. Here to speak on behalf of the North Dakota ethanol industry and the North Dakota Ethanol Council, we would like to express our neutral position on the proposed amendments to the grain warehouse and grain buyer bonds. We appreciate the work the Public Service Commission is doing to ensure a balance between protecting North Dakota agriculture producers and providing affordable bonding to the state's ag processors. We recognize the need for change given recent insolvencies and do not feel the proposed amendments will put a significant financial burden on the ethanol plants in our state. However, we are also not confident that this solution provides a level of protection needed for producers given the value of today's commodities and volatility in the markets. At this time, the cost to ensure 100% bonding coverage in the states in every scenario may not be cost-effective for businesses and may be a barrier for processes considering locating in the state. As the Commission explores this important topic further, we would be happy to continue to engage in dialogue on this topic. This concludes my testimony today.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. You know, when we go downstairs and testify neutral, the legislature always beats us up on it. So just pick a side, right? So I find myself on the other side of that equation now, right? So it's clear, though, that you're watching this very closely.
Correct.
Do you have any thoughts about if the commission or anyone was ever to go down the road of what is a producer, what you would classify, how you would define that?
You mean a processor?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. I view this as risk management, and to separate processors from elevators or others, I don't believe would have value in the entire risk management process here.
Okay.
So any given facility could have volume turns above 7 times their annual volume. You look at some of the large shuttle loaders, I'm pretty confident they're seeing turns greater than that. However, an ethanol facility typically would turn more than 7 times inventory, just speaking in general for our industry. But I don't personally see from a risk management standpoint and the purpose of the bonds, the purpose of the indemnity funds, and the purpose of the changes to the bond where a processor would be necessarily treated or needed to be treated different than anybody else procuring and moving commodities.
Sure, so make a better understanding of the risk profile that the company presents is a better way to look at it than trying to define it. Okay. Thank you. That was the only questions I had. Commissioner Crispin?
Without giving out information that you don't want to give out, for the industry in general, what kind of volumes of turning over your capacity do you suppose are the norm of the substantial ethanol producers?
Sure. Commissioner, I can speak on behalf of the two facilities that I'm involved with. So Blue Flint Ethanol, we currently produce 65 million gallons a year of ethanol. We consume about 24 million bushels a year of corn, and we've expanded our inventories to about 3.2 million bushels worth of storage capacity. Dakota Spirit Ag Energy will be starting up. It will consume about 23 million bushels a year of corn, and it will have 1.5 million bushels of storage on site. I think in general, the industry was built around about 30 days storage on site, if just generally how we're plants storage sized. That would be a good estimation.
I was writing so fast. I don't think I have any other questions right now, but maybe by the time Commissioner Fedorchak's done.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate having you here. You say here in your testimony that we're not confident this solution provides the level of protection needed for producers in today's marketplace. At the same time, 100% would be cost prohibitive. So there's a big – so what's the difference? Where's the sweet spot in between there?
Well, Commissioner, we support we're neutral to this, but we recognize and support the need for change, as we've stated here. We recognize that based on volume turns, there potentially was a need for change. So to speak to the 100%, it's really difficult to say what would be 100% coverage based on the commodity values. So to try and carry bonds for worst-case scenarios and trying to cover 100% of worst-case scenario, we don't think would be cost-effective and perhaps would be a barrier for business in the state and maybe lead folks to looking for bonding methods outside of the state.
And I agree with you. I think 100% is a target that I'm not shooting for. But your line here about that this solution doesn't necessarily provide the protection needed makes me think that you think we're not going far enough right now with this proposal. Is that what you intended to suggest?
No, not necessarily. That wasn't our intent.
Okay.
Just stating that in many cases in an insolvency, this still may not make the producers whole.
Okay. Let's see. I think you covered kind of the processor description. I don't think I have any other questions for you either, Jeff. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. The cost of electricity is probably as big a cost concern of yours as anything as well, right?
Certainly energy is a big part of our process.
Yeah, I know, because we've had a lot of discussion in our rate cases about what this might do to, electricity changes for you just, pennies make huge differences. So.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Back
to Commissioner Crispin.
Ms. Richter testified that the staff estimate is like 65% to 70% of transactions are credit sales. You don't have to answer this stuff if it's trade secret or something, but does that seem like about what you experience at your plants? Would you say about two-thirds or a little better are credit sale contracts and the rest are cash?
Commissioner, no, that's not the case at our facility. Substantially less credit sales than cash sales.
And do you get very many customers that are concerned about your bonding or anything like that, or are they just mainly concerned about their agreement for providing corn and getting money?
Commissioner, I believe that's a very valid question in that we believe that we present very little risk, so we would like for our suppliers to understand the financial health of our organization, and we think that's part of risk management. Somebody pointed out earlier that if you start to hear rumors about a failing industry, you probably don't want to keep delivering. So I think prudent business decisions, prudent risk management should be first and foremost in anybody that you're doing business with. And we believe that we represent a sound place to do business. So I think that's the foundation. And then from there it's primarily contract pricing mechanisms around basis or cash prices. But bonding questions very rarely, if ever, come up.
Okay. No other questions, but thanks for being here, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
I would also say, Jeff, I appreciate you guys expressing that you recognize the need for some updates. That's helpful.
Thank you.
All right. Does anyone else wish to testify today in front of the commission on this issue? Anyone else going twice? Anyone else going three times? Okay. All the comments provided today have been collected by Daryl. Also, anyone wishing to provide written comments has until December 26th, and they'll be considered and discussed in our decision. Any changes to the proposed rule due to the commission's review or comments received by the commission will be explained in our written decision. This record will remain open until Friday, December 26, 2014. I'll now close the portion of the hearing on GE14-763. Before I refer to my colleagues for closing comments, I just want to make sure, Alana, could you walk us through the procedure now? Give the time frame that Randy's kind of queued it up a little bit, but just walk through here what happens in the next 45 days for all of us.
Well, comments can still come in, and in fact, we had one today that that was docketed on grain. Person didn't come, but the comment is here. So comments can still come in. After that, the commission will incorporate into its thought process those comments and what you heard today and decide what to do with the rules, change them, move forward, not do them, whatever. So at some point after that 26th of December, there will be a decision on a commission meeting. Let's assume the commission decides to go ahead and promulgate rules. Then after the commission has a meeting to make that decision, it goes to the Attorney General's office for review as to legality, and we get an opinion back from the Attorney General at some point a few weeks down the road from that, probably a little longer if it's during session, whether the rules are legal or not. And assuming it comes back as legal, then they go back to the commission agenda for a motion to submit them to the Legislative Council. Sometimes they come back from the Attorney General's office and they need to be tweaked. Once they're at the Legislative Council, they're scheduled for the next Administrative Rules Committee hearing, which could be, they're only quarterly, so if you get at the beginning of that quarter, you're going to be waiting almost 3 months.
That was one thing I wanted to highlight to the crowd here, anybody listening, is that that's yet another chance. If the rules come out that you don't quite like or something, you've got yet another chance
right.
to say what you do or don't like about it at that point in time.
Right. And then if they get through that committee, then they are effective. There's a statutory date after that meeting. So there's several hoops to jump through before they're actually effective.
Okay, yes, ma'am.
So in this process, because this is my first time doing this too, what if there's changes? Does it have to be re-noticed in another hearing on, like, say, you know, we change something on these rules?
I think that might depend on the nature of the change, and I wouldn't know that until it was concluded. I think something like the suggestion that you keep some kind of bans, let's say, mm-hmm. which are existing today. Several people have made a comment, because the written comment that came in said the same thing, about the bans having some relevance. So if you decided, well, okay, we're going to stick with bans, that by itself might not cause you to re-notice it, because it's not something brand new to the people out there reading about the rule. However, if in trying to keep a ban, you run into a lot of substantive changes with the percentages, right. you know, in trying to actually do it and do the other things, it gets confusing or complicated. You might say, yeah, we should re-notice this. Because now it's like a different scheme. I don't know the answer, but I thought of it when the people were speaking, that that's a good example of it might be simple enough, non-substantive, to not notice it, and it might end up being substantive enough that you'd have to re-notice.
And then when the legislature approves it, is it just up or down? Or do they make, can there be changes that they make?
They can make changes, but they come back, and I have to double-check the this is what I think would happen. I don't know of the legislature rewriting a line and then the rule taking effect that way. I have been more, it hasn't happened to us, but I have observed other people where the legislature, the committee has suggestions back to the agency, and the agency is standing up there saying, okay, we'll take that back and talk about it. So that's the way I think it happens. Technically, it might be able to just tweak it and make it effective, but I don't know for sure today without looking it up.
But if there's substantive changes along the way at any point, it's re-noticed and there's another
process
like this.
Because a person out there reading the rule, if it's something that person would not guess was going to happen at this hearing or be talked about at this hearing, then they need that opportunity to look at it.
I would say it's also kind of up to the three of us. If we decide that that's changes we want to re-notice it, then we just do it to be on the safe side. I just want to walk through that because it's a process for all of you, and I really appreciate everybody, you know, coming out today, because it takes, you know, it's taken a lot of work to get it this far. Staff, we've gone through numerous meetings about trying to get to this tweak and that tweak, so it takes a while to get here. It's really great that all of you came today and gave us your feedback, because the worst thing we can do is put something forward and then, oh, wait, we don't like that. Well, let's hear about it now. So that's, I guess, the only comments I would have. Commissioner Crispin, any final thoughts?
I do. First of all, this whole rulemaking process, as I alluded to earlier, has been a learning process for me. You know, I knew that as a commissioner, we didn't just have infinite power to just change whatever rules we want to, but I didn't know it took close to a half a year.
You can blame the legislators
to do that.
Previous ones expected.
I'll take some of the blame there, too. But I do thank everybody for coming. We got a lot of good food for thought. I think it's important that we address these issues, but it's most important that we find good solutions and good workable solutions. I also just want to take a moment to introduce a good friend of mine who served the great people of District 33 very well years ago in the North Dakota House of Representatives at a time when budgets didn't have shortfalls, Mr. Gary Cannell from up at Hazen.
Hey, Gary.
Thanks,
Gary. No other comments.
So did you ever have to work with Randy in the legislature, you said, before you were there?
He's quite a bit younger than I am. So. he was busy herding cattle at that time. It wasn't into the political thing at that time.
All right, thank you.
Very kind of you to consider me younger. I'll buy supper now.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk, any comments?
I don't have any closing comments except to say thanks again, and we will continue working on these and hopefully come up with a good product here.
All right, well, we've closed the hearings now. We closed the hearings now. We'll close the meeting. Thank you all.